what we're going to do is we're going to be looking at this from not only a theological perspective. Who's the theologian here?
In your family, whose voice you can still hear. Name may still be living or not, but sometimes, and something, maybe a friend, somebody says something maybe insignificant or meaningful or whatever, but you remember a certain tone or a certain lilt of the voice, and that you sort of carry that with you, even though you couldn't for the life of you remember exactly what was said. There's something in the voice that maybe you meet a stranger or somebody else that has that same lilt, and it catches your attention, which it did for me. When I was raised on a farm in southern Illinois, and left the farm and came to California early on, but I still heard my father's voice. And we'll wait 30 seconds, here comes some kids. I assume they're going to go somewhere else, so I'll make sure. If they're taping this, they bought this really strange tape. Okay, my father's voice. In the winter, my father worked the big horses in the fields, hauling out the stumps. As I ran along the furrows where ice held the dead stock stiff and straight in the hard ground. And at night, when steam rose off the sweating backs of the team, he moved among the harness and sweet-smelling hay in the dark barn, talking softly to them as their wet hides rippled beneath his heavy hands. Later, when my brother's breathing eased in our room beneath the eaves, I went to the window and pressed myself against the cold glass and watched the farm appear and disappear in the rain. And my father's voice came up the stairs like thunder a long way off. Now, when trees are wet and bent against the windows, our children come to our bed and press their warm bodies against us, wanting stories, and fall asleep with rain sluicing through the rain gutters, the team coming up from the fields, lifting their heavy legs in and out of the wet grass, their coats glistening like jewels in the mist, my father driving them, his voice rising and falling in the cold air. So there's a memory of boyhood things on the farm. And those farm memories tend to stick with you, like any memories when you're a child, when you're young. It doesn't matter where you are, all memories. There was a couple of rivers near our farm in southern Illinois, and they would invariably get out over the banks during a flood. And I can remember my uncles and my father and my three cousins sort of raised together in this farm, and we would sort of try to keep the river out of places. As kids, we didn't know what we were doing, of course. The adults were sandbagging and putting things up, but the rivers always got out anyway, went through the hen house and broke up everything. And I can remember my father telling us in no uncertain terms to stay the bleep out of the river, which, of course, we didn't. Naturally, we headed for the river. But this is called the river. When we were young, our father told us to stay away from the river. That was all. But he never told us not to love the way it rolled over its banks and flood and took the barns and upper garden, or to turn away from the river at sundown when it caught fire in last light, or pretend we couldn't hear it washing against its banks at night from our room beneath the eaves. He knew what it could do, he said. But when he forgot what he told us and stood by the river waiting for rain to pock the quiet surface, we let him be and did not call him in to eat the cold meat on the table. It was something in the water, he said, that called him. It called us, too, but we were locked in that tyranny of time and things the young cannot understand. And so we watched him there on the levee and waited for it to end. Though I am gone, I remember the river and wonder if the farm is green in spring rain, and if they raise themselves on elbows in the night to listen to the water rolling beneath the old bridge, for fear the river will find them in their farm sleep and flood them with their voices, my father heard as the river rose and fell, carrying bits of the farm away. And we hold ourselves stiffly between the cold sheets and watch the moonlight on the heavy curtains and wonder at the river that flows around us and through us, carrying us into another country. Our children stir in their rooms and listen to the river and press their faces against the cold window, their eyes wide, their breath, small puffs of cloud in the dark. So the farm is gone where we were, but the river is still flowing. There was a person here at Holden years ago, probably back in the 70s, on staff. Can't remember his name. He was from West Virginia, I think. And we were sitting in this room, and we were talking about times, how times pass, memories linger, and all that. And somebody asked him how it was there now. And I remember his aunt, he said, the times are gone, but the mountain's still there. Just that one line. It wasn't used as a poem, it was just in conversation, recounting his own boyhood days. In fact, he was still a young man. The times are gone, but the mountain's still there. That's like this, the times are gone, but the river is still there. Whoever's on that farm or near it will hear the same river and hear the same mysterious voices. And somebody will say to stay the hell out of the water. And of course, if they're kids, they won't, which is why they'll remember it forever. Another memory I have, very strong memory of the farm, is with my aunts and female cousins. There were three houses, all dilapidated. Of course, I thought they were mansions, but when I grew up and went back, I saw they were shacks. But when I was little, I didn't know I was poor because I was happy. The whole place was sort of run by my grandmother, who was sort of the matriarch of the clan. And I was struck by the fact that the field hands, my father and my uncles and all the hired hands would come in and eat first. And my grandmother and aunts and cousins would sort of stand around behind them and take the dishes to the table. And then eat second table, as they called it. When the men would go back to the fields, then the women would eat. And I sort of grew up thinking that's the way things were, and that most women's names were women or woman and not didn't have first names at all. And I was struck by the fact that the weather, the harsh Illinois weather and poor crops and all that had a way of beating down people and it took its toll on everybody. Particularly, I thought the women, even as a kid, I sensed that, because I sensed the men had other things outside, and somehow the women were, I saw them half in shadow always. My mother was always moving in shadows, or my grandmother turning off certain lights in the house. We'd all gather around the wood-burning stove in the kitchen. So this poem is about the problem that women sometimes have on those farms, called Like Country Women. After a week of wind, she took to standing by a long window that looked over the garden and to the creek that ran through the small copse of woods near the barn. No one said anything to her when she stood like that. No one laughed or tried to make her talk. When the rains began, she would take her book to the window niche and open it on her lap and sit looking out at the swollen stream as it raised itself over the grassy banks and flooded the garden, finding each furrow with fingers of water that closed itself like a hand. If he had come to her then, it might have mattered. If he had asked about the book or brought her, laughing, a flower from the upper garden where they had raised the earth on rock from the dry stream bed the day she spread her new dress around her on the warm grass and smelled the thick scent of cut hay and damp earth. But the days changed then, and like country women, she changed into the dress her mother made for her and carried the buckets up the steps to the bathroom and held the light in the barn as they moved among the heavy cows with the thick medicine to save the new calf, smelling the heavy, sweet smell of milk on the mother who laid her weight against her calf as if to press life back into it. And when the first snows banked against the cellar door, she wondered at the absence of any sound at all and watched the men go over the hill, leaving black marks in the white, their shoulders hunched over in the cold, the wind drifting snow into their footprints behind them as if they had suddenly appeared in the snow and moved slowly into the dark trees with no sign or sound to show they were men. But no one asked her about what she saw or what she felt. They left her to the cold room and ate in the kitchen around the long table near the stove, silently, hunkered over their biscuits and gravy and their coffee, their hats and hoods still on their heads, ice on the bristles of their beards. It was at night that she saw it all, knew she was there, as the horses and cows were there, as the furniture with the drop cloths were there, and that she had as little voice or dream. When the house was asleep, and she stood by the window and watched the moon catch in the plum tree orchard, she knew the fox was moving through the frozen garden, carefully lifting his slender legs in and out of the melting snow, growling at the new ice in the ruts from the wagon that brought the seed and bulb she had asked for. Tomorrow she would plant them after digging up the dark earth where she could. The men would laugh at her there in the wet garden, telling her it was too soon, too early for that, and they would shoulder their bright axes and go to the deep woods where she would hear the sharp crack of them biting into the ash and balsam. Still, she would sit there in her garden and work her hands into the hard dirt, dropping the seed carefully into the ground, covering it and patting down the rich earth, watching him go with the men, not looking back, wanting to lay her body down in the dark earth in the narrow furrow with the seed, feeling the dampness rise into her body, smelling the wild honeysuckle on the broken trellis, her hands working the cold earth, drawing spring into them. So there's yet another memory of the women on the farm. By the way, since there's such a small group of us here, but intense and appreciative group, if you'd like, we can stop at any time if you want to ask questions or say anything and just sort of be easy about it. Because there's nothing sacred about a poetry reading.
Where in Illinois? How far south? Because I'm an Illinois person. I want to know where you work.
About 50 miles east of St. Louis. A little town called Greenville. Where are you from?
Rock Island. Right on the Mississippi.
Really? I went to Augustana. I was raised in, born in Minnesota, raised in Iowa, and I'm out at graduate school now at Central Washington University. So.
When were you at Augustana?
It's about 4 years ago.
Time passes. I live right on the campus, presently.
Oh, really?
It sounds. I'll talk to you later.
Am I right that it sounds like your mother is lonely? Unappreciated?
I think so, and now that I look back on it, not all the women were, I think, but I sense that she was.
It's a hard life.
It is a hard life, and my mother was in the farm, but not of the farm, I think. And for that matter, I'm not sure my father was all that much, too. I kind of sensed a distance between all my aunts and uncles and my own parents. And everybody had their own jobs to do, just like at Holden Village, but I had, even as a kid, a sort of a mythic sense about it all. And that loneliness or the darkness of the barns and the inability or lack of communication, or they lost the inclination to speak to each other, particularly during the winters, and everything was dark and locked up, and shadows and low voices, and all that made a tremendous impression on me, which I never grew out of. So that's where most of the poems come back, trying to find out what that was all about. I never found out what it was all about, but it led to poems. All right, this is a poem called Carlinda's Song. I wrote several poems about a woman I made up. Her name was Carlinda Maines McCormick, which is another story which is not particularly interesting how that came about, but that's her name. And Carlinda is one of the, she's a new breed back on the farm, and she is of the mind that I don't have to put up with this stuff. Unlike her her older sisters or aunts, she decides one day that she's had it and there must be something outside of Greenville, Illinois, outside of Bond County, although my aunt insists there is not. People in Greenville, Illinois are almost as parochial as people from Minnesota or Washington or New York, New Yorkers who say if it's not happening in New York, it's not happening. So wherever you are parochial, I think. This is Carlinda's song. Carlinda Maines McCormick waited by the old gate with her suitcase strapped tight and a bag of crackers open on her lap. Her father told her to get the hell out if that's what she wanted. Just go do it, but don't write him later when Bobby Havoke turned up missing or started to get mean after his first crop failed or the rain stayed on too long. She walked the 2 miles to the interstate thinking he meant to meet her by the overpass. The crackers are almost gone, and the suitcase straps broke and spilled her new nightgown on the ground, and a trucker blew his horn at her and made her jump into the horse weeds by the side of the road. The only people in Bridie's Cafe were truckers and a couple from Iowa who talked about their kids out in California who raised some kind of pigs that everyone wanted. A pot-bellied pig that you could keep in the house. Carlinda stirred her coffee and wondered about a pig in her house. The counter girl brought her the change from the telephone, but she just left it on the table in front of her and watched the big clock and waited for his pickup to bounce over the ruts in front of the cafe. But at 5, he had not come. And the cook looked at her over the pass-through and talked to the girl counting the money. She knew her father would be coming in from the field, his back hot and sticky with chaff, looking in the icebox for some cold meat she had cut up for him. 3 fresh eggs lay on the clean towel in the sink. He could fry eggs, she thought. At 8 o'clock, a trucker who played Furlan Husky on the jukebox walked over to her and said it simple. Arizona ain't California, or whoever it was she was waiting for, but he'd like to drive slow and see some sights along the way, and when he got to Flagstaff, he thought he'd stay there and see what he could do. And he reached down and scooped up all the change and handed it to her, and that was that. Later, as the moonlight dusted the hood and windows of the big truck, Carlinda watched herself staring back in the window and him lighting a cigarette, catching a small pop of orange light against his smooth cheek, and thought her father was right. To hell with Bobby Avoki, and fell asleep with the cracker box on her lap, spelling Flagstaff on the small puff of cloud she breathed onto the window. So Carlinda's out of there. Said, I've had enough of this. But not many people left. And the people are, my relatives are still back there in this small town where I'll be in about 3 weeks. One more time. Where I go to just walk around this section, go into the barbershop in one chair, and not talk like a Californian, not talk too fast, but just sort of sidle up and lean against the window, maybe spit on the floor, scratch, until somebody says, hot, ain't it? And I don't want to answer too fast. Just nod would be better. And then somebody else would say, sure is. How's your hogs? And after about a half hour of that, then I'll say something. That's the way it's done. It sounds odd, doesn't it? But you know how it is. All right, here's a sonnet. 14 lines of iambic pentameter and all that stuff. It's called Much Too Small. On the horizon, a storm comes across our upper fields, blowing all the leaves white to the wind. We sit in darkness around the stove and wonder how safe we are in living here, if it will miss our place, leaving maples and sweet gum scraping against our windows. And when at last it rumbles in the bottoms far away, we laugh and walk beneath the rain-washed trees and say, this summer storm was much too small to scare us into hiding very long. But laughing stopped at the sudden sound of thunder overhead, leaving us feeling small about who and where we were.
Jack, when you say something about place, I mean, clearly all these are from your life on the farm. Mm-hmm. What happened when you moved? Do you still have the eye for your early place?
Yes.
Or how long did it take you to get a new place, or did you ever?
Never did. I've got, it's a good question. I've got some poems about California, of course, because I've lived there for a gazillion years now. They're not particularly strong. When I do write about Southern California, they tend to have an edge, a bite, which may be in keeping more with urban life than farm life. But there's no history there for me except family, as if that's not enough. That's a lot of tradition and history. But the sights and sounds and the magic or the terror, and there was plenty of that on the farm, that we were raised by
madmen, now that I think about it, all my uncles, they thought the best thing to do is to scare the heck out of kids and keep them scared constantly. They meant no harm. They thought it was great fun to scare kids. So that had a great effect. So moving to California didn't do anything. When I write, still to this day, probably 95-98% of the poems are from that era. This is Wild Grapes. Come to the house, grandmother. The wild grapes are covered with snow and the ponds are ice. The grapes you picked in summer are gone, and vines cling to the trellis in the upper garden, where birds drive their beaks into the iron ground near the barn, where pigeons brush their wings against the rafters in the dark. Come to the house, grandmother. The one you look for is gone, and the woods are empty of song. The wagon is frozen in its ruts, where he waved as he came up from the fields, mist glittering on the horses like jewels. Come to the house, grandmother, and sleep. I'll close the cellar door to keep the cold from you upstairs, where you watch the moonlight on the curtains, and dream of summer when you watched him climb the hill to the upper garden where you moved, half in shadow, the green vines catching at your clothes, spilling the purple clusters in your hands. As I was getting ready to read tonight, I was trying to get a balance of happy poems, and I discovered there weren't any. So I don't have much of a balance here. There are some things that is sort of amusing in one way or another, but in looking over a manuscript or a life's work, and I've been writing for a lot of years, on balance, it's... I think your question sort of goes to the heart of it. You have to remember, as Wordsworth said, you see sort of with an inner eye, you have to see who you are and where you came from. Then you have to have a voice. And once I heard the voice, once I heard my way, then I never looked back. So since my memories tend to be in darkness, that's where the voice comes from, that's where the eye sees. And most of that is not tragic, but it's not happy. I have had some tremendously happy times as a kid, but in looking back, there's sort of a patina of shade over everything, pretty much. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't call them happy. But having said that, I gotta find a happy song. There's one called Bright Spot Cafe, which came about in this way. Several years ago, I was reading poems in the Midwest, and I read at St. Olaf College and our university. And then I went down to some college in Iowa. I think it was Waldorf. Would that have been right in Forest City?
Yeah.
And I got there, and nobody knew I was coming. They had fouled up their schedule or something. And I stood around the lobby of the student center or something with a satchel of poems. Finally, somebody said, "What are you here for?" And I said, "I'm reading poems." He said, "Well, we don't want any poets." I said, "Oh, thanks." And they said, "You've got the wrong day." Well, I didn't. They did. So I got back in the car and drove back to St. Olaf because I was supposed to be there that night anyway for another reading. And as I went, I had rented this car. I had a tough time stopping because as a child, when we came from the farm and lived in a place called Inglewood, California, my dad always wanted to go back every Christmas and every summer to visit the folks, the family. So California was never his home. It was always still back on the farm. So he would load the 38 Dodge with me and two or three dogs and whatever, and my mother, whose name I thought was Woman, because that's what he called her. And we would drive old 66 all the way back to St. Louis, across the river, and into the farm country to Greenville. And after 1,000 miles or so, I needed to go to the bathroom, of course, and I can remember saying, "Got to stop the car, Dad. I got to go to the bathroom." He said, "I can't. Got to get down the line." And he was always getting down this mythical, and I always look over his shoulders trying, wondering, what line does he have to get down? And his shoulders were massive, and he would hunched over the wheel for this old 38 Dodge, and I was in agony and misery in the back seat. And I finally said, "You got to stop." He says, "Oh, well, look for a bathroom." So, man, I was really looking for a bathroom because I was desperate. And I would see one. I said, "There's one." He said, "Oh, it's on the wrong side. We got to get down the line." And he kept going. He said, "We'll get on the way back." On the way back, it was on the wrong side.
I've had that experience too.
So I got to the point where my dad would not stop, and so I knew better than to ever ask him to stop. He always had to get down the line. Then he would pull into some little town at 9 o'clock at night, it was dark, and he'd say, "Woman, go see what you can find in a motel for $5. Well, I was a kid. I didn't know for $5 you couldn't even say hello. And she would come back, and we'd go through this litany. "I'm sorry, they're all full up." My dad said, "Well, I guess we'll have to sleep on the ground," which is exactly what he had planned anyway. So he took a blanket and threw out on the ground, which my mother euphemistically referred to as a Baptist pallet. And my dad would say, "Have the kids sleep there." That was me. I didn't know my name was Jack until I was 11. So I slept on the ground. Woman, my mother, would sort of wander off somewhere. I never knew where she went. My dad hunched his arms over the wheel, which he had not relinquished once anyway. And the dogs would be snuffling about under the car or growling at somebody on the street. And we would sleep, or try to sleep. And then just when I would get to sleep, about 4:30 or so, my dad would be kicking me with his shoes, saying, "Time to get up, gotta get down the line." And if I had been a little saltier, I'd say, "What line are we talking about here?" But of course I didn't. I just got up, my dad and get in, and away we'd go. So here I am on the way back to St. Olaf with all this history, this baggage, gotta get down the line. And I was unwanted at Waldorf College, apparently. And on the left was the Bright Spot Cafe. And I thought, I'm going to stop and turn into that and get a cup of coffee. And the wheel wouldn't turn left because I knew my dad would be looking over my shoulder saying, "Get down the line, don't waste time." And I thought, I'm an adult, I'm a grown man, I can turn this car. Get that? And I finally turned that car. And I screeched to a stop, sweating, palms perspiring, nervous, feared my dad must be in the back seat. And so the poem, Bright Spot Cafe. The sign read, "Eat." And the soft April rain I pulled across the gravel white rock road. "Use other door." There wasn't but one door. And inside, the old timers laughed and pointed at my fumbling. Inside, to a quiet table and the waitress. "Bring me a cheeseburger and coffee." "Want the cottage cheese?" "No, just the cheeseburger and coffee." "Don't you want the cottage cheese?" "No, just, how about them French fries?" She stood a while as I studied the tablecloth, then sidled over to the window and gave my order. "And he don't want the cottage cheese." Such a hush then. The ramrod-backed farmers turned on their stools to gape my way. I flushed hot and studied the mysteries of my menu that showed the map of Iowa saying, "You are here, Dubuque is." And finally, to look up at the eating faces all engrossed in their cottage cheese. The man across the aisle shoveling it in while his mother gave him what for with each mouthful. "I say no mutton chops. Mustache okay, but them chops point to your nose, Roger." And words trailing off to a table next to mine. "Dewey's is the best. There's a new man there who lays them out so natural you wouldn't believe it. And they's reasonable. $74 gets your casket, wreath of forget-me-nots, and an ad in the Advocate. And that new man lays them out so natural." Finally, my cheeseburger. Small, rounded cheese, unmelted. I look in vain for onion, pickle, lettuce, and the hovering waitress noticing my hesitation. "Now you want your cottage cheese?" And silence again in the Bright Spot Cafe as chrome stools turn, farmers look, and conversations hang suspended in beatific silence. "Yes," I say, and Iowa resumes its humanistic center of the universe as heresies and dreams alike are laid to rest, looking very natural. So even out of some sort of angst as a kid, you can remember something. And that voice again is my father saying, "Gotta get down the line, gotta get down the line." He would drive literally from Inglewood, California, which is about 35 miles from Los Angeles, nonstop to Albuquerque or Flagstaff. He would do that regularly. Well, Flagstaff's not so bad, but Albuquerque's a long haul. Then from Albuquerque, clear to St. Louis. I think I still have my father in me because when we came from Thousand Oaks to come up here, Dolores and I drove 2 620-mile days. Got here absolutely sick and exhausted. But I knew my father would have been I'm very appreciative of that. This is a new poem. I have 3 or 4 new ones here, and so you'll be the first audience to hear this. It's called Last Letter to Rose. She told them it was the weather. Rain, sleet, and thunderstorms, and floods that carried the eggs out of the hen house that did it. But it was the raccoon in the dumpster that drove her out of the country, Rose said. Away from cow pies in the barn lot and the long winters when heat was saved for when it really turned cold. It was the raccoon that did it, finally, after every evening when she took out the trash and his two beady eyes looked up at her amidst the cantaloupe rinds and cabbages, always reaching a nasty little hand up toward her, the opposing thumb working and snapping as if she were another melon to snatch down into his smelly and steaming den. So she packed her good dresses. She even left her books, half eaten by rats, in the cellar next to the clean jars and brown eggs she gathered, then waited for second table to eat after the hired men hunched over their biscuits and gravy, and he washed his hands at the sink, his clothes bloody from cleaning the rabbits he shot that morning in the garden, the noise exploding in her head over and over, echoing through the wild plum orchard. There was no way to talk to him then about how it was with her and her memories of green parks next to her mother's place in Cincinnati, and her cousin Rose, who pleaded with her not to go to the country, and how they all had a party out on the big lawn when she left, showing all of them the picture of him standing on the wide board porch, his hat low over his eyes, making him look different, she said. Strange, her cousin Rose said, sipping a large lemonade and removing the wide hat and mopping her brow with a lace handkerchief the man from St. Louis gave her on their trip to see the arch and came back sick from some kind of clams eaten on a boat in the river, where Rose learned to steer the boat, she said, from a man who never brought the boat down to Cincinnati after all, but she kept the handkerchief scented in her bosom. So she packed her things and drove the pickup around the white rock road to the highway and waved to him as he plowed the upper garden. And it was with relief and a touch of regret that she left that shithole, as she termed it in the last letter to Rose, that she would not be there to see him when he banged through the screen door looking for lunch, his clothes wet and heavy with chaff from cleaning the silo, the old dog whining behind the stove, his voice hard and mean as he called up to her, listening for her moving in the upstairs rooms, pulling the cold meat from the icebox, already reaching for the 12-gauge over the door. The gun she took down and smashed over and over with a hammer until it barely hung together, putting it carefully back on the rack over the door. So she just waved to him and kept moving, her eyes on the long stretch of hard road, the center line disappearing beneath her, the horizon squeezing the farm behind her where he stood in fury at the door, the broken gun at his feet, the rabbits dancing in the garden, and the raccoon moiling and grunting in his dumpster. So she escaped too. Anything you'd like to say? Questions? Any of this ring any bells? I hope not. You just have a raccoon in your dumpster. Are there any raccoons up here, Tim?
Nope.
Too high, huh?
Yeah, never seen one. Skunk, but...
Skunk in your dumpster. Well, I think I'll shift gears, but not before I read another new poem. It was just published in a magazine in Southern Illinois, University of Illinois at Edwardsville, called In the First Pale Light of Spring. When she rose in the first pale light of spring, she woke him and pointed to the corner where the cradle caught the light through the heavy curtains. She raised the window, letting the fresh smells into the room. Machinery rusted in the fields, and the empty silo rose above the thorn trees. "Too bad it's a girl," he said at last. She stood at the window and did not speak, though there was much she meant to say, something about the rain and long winters, and her good clothes boxed in the root cellar with the clean jars and eggs and the dark farm silence between them. But she knew he was thinking of his breakfast of hot biscuits and gravy and the old dog cracking her bones on the gunny sack behind the stove, waiting to go with him to the fields. Thunder rolled in the bottoms as he swung his feet out and walked stiffly toward the stairs, curling his toes from the cold floor. "She won't be help to me here. You'll have to teach her something." His voice ballooned up the stairwell and echoed in the bare rooms. "Oh, I will," she whispered. "I will teach her something." And she pressed her body full against the cold window as the farm appeared and disappeared in the rain, and her face stared back from the greening fields. So that's got kind of a bite to it, kind of a little edge. This is a book that was published by Valparaiso University Press years ago, and I think there's two left in existence, and this is one of them that belongs to the library here. It was illustrated by a fellow named Jerry Brummer. I wish I could show you the illustrations, but you could always check it out. Beautiful illustrations about the people and the farm or whatever it is that I'm talking about. And in fact, if I'm not mistaken, I wrote two poems up here, two or three poems, just four up here, and this is called "The Salt Lick at Daybreak, Holden Village, Washington, 1974. I'd forgotten about this poem. You'll remember that there used to be salt licks out behind the chalet. I don't think there are anymore. Are they?
They had them on at the ballpark, I thought.
They probably did, yeah, and they used to be back here. So I'll read this anyway, and there's one of the mountains in the background, Jerry Brown, beautiful illustration. This is why I got a C- in audiovisual at Pepperdine University. You see that? That's great. the teacher would say, "Can we just do that one?" I said, "Okay." So then he called me in privately and said, "You're not going to pass this class unless you have to be able to string, or whatever you call it, a Bell and Howell projector." And everybody had done it, and through the loops, they don't do that. And there's, what's a projector, kids would say, right? Today, put in a video cartridge. And every time I tried, I would break the film, or sprockets would be spinning it off, and he would just hold his head, the poor guy, and he said, "Can't you do this?" He said, "I've got to pass you. The best you can do is a C-, because you can't." So he called me in privately and said, "You open this sprocket and put the thing here, and close the sprocket, and bring the tape down here, and it comes out on the thing." And I screwed it up, and he said, "I'll tell you what, just get out." He says, "I'll give you a C-, but you got to promise me one thing." I said, "Anything." He says, "Never, never be a teacher." I said, "I promise." That was 40 years ago. And so even today, when I do audiovisual things in my classroom, the first thing I do is go to the phone, call up the audiovisual department, and say, "I need..." and send someone, because it'll come back. And when I go into the faculty office to Xerox something, they see me coming and run out real fast and say, "Here, let me do that for you," because the machine just automatically goes berserk after I touch it. Anyway, this is "The Salt Lick at Daybreak, Holden Village." The salt block stands like a lamp. The long tongues reach out of the trees and caress the corners of the salt. The mountains move forward, press against the thing. The ground sucks through fern hairs that move in blind orgiastic circles, and low moans escape the shards of rock and limb that cannot come. The feast glides on tripod feet, clicking on stars, dropping bits of salt on the mucused leaves. And morning comes like sudden sparrows to peck and scratch, and the mountains pull back down their glacier gullies. The trees bend backwards towards cool deeps, and the long tongues slide after the deer, who move in light from bark and stone. I think we stayed in Chalet 3 that summer, or Chalet 1, 74. All right, here's a poem called, anyone want to say anything before I read another one? This is called Eleanor and Murph's Place in B, Nebraska. And that had become so mythic for me that I was glad to run into somebody we were talking to somebody up here a few days ago that actually had been to...
Well, they live in Seward.
They live in Seward, Nebraska.
Where we live.
Yeah, and they had actually been out to Eleanor and Murph's Place way out in the country in B-E-E. They had great names in that part of Nebraska, like Beaver Crossing, which is a wonderful name. B... And then there was this delightful town called Ong, O-N-G, and there were these great names, which nobody ever heard of. But I taught at Seward, at Concordia College, and was working in graduate work at the U in Lincoln. So in order to escape the pressures of graduate school, Dolores and I would go, and if the kids were there, we'd take them out to this little tavern, where for 40 cents, On a paper plate, you would get two pieces of fried, deep-fried white fish. I still remember this. One slice of white bread, no butter, and one round of pickle for 40 cents. And then we'd take a glass of beer back to your table, and we'd sit on an old table with an old moose head with a newspaper stuck in his mouth. And it'd be signs on the windows, you know, a softball. It was very old world, very bohemian, very country. Well, this particular night, we happened to be there on the night. Two interesting things happened. We were sitting under our moose head, having our beer and fish. And Sonny and Cher show was on television, bits and pieces. You remember Sonny before he was Congressman Sonny Bono? I went to high school with Sonny Bono. His name is Sammy, really.
Sammy
is his real name, but he got Sonny. And Sonny and Sammy and I went to dances every Friday night at the rec room for 4 years at Inglewood High School before he got kicked out of high school. I shouldn't tell you about the congressman. And when he was married to Cher, and they had these funny 60 clothes, and they would do these You Got Me Babe songs back and forth. And so we were sort of watching that. And then that show was either interrupted or the news came on, and there was the moon landing. This would have been in
69.
And Neil Armstrong taking that great leap for mankind thing. Very dramatic. So we paused to watch this. And there were four men in bib overalls, obviously local farmers, playing pinochle or something in the middle of the tavern. I remember two of them were drinking wine and beer Boilermakers, which I thought was a terrible thing to look at. But they were playing cards, and they were stopped, you know, how's this, and all of us, and we were watching the moon landing, and they could have cared less. Till finally somebody stopped. They looked, they said, what is that? And they reared back, and they looked up like that. And Neil Armstrong drops down and says, giant leap for mankind. And one farmer looks at him and says, do you believe that? And the guy says, hell no. They went right back to the plane. I knew we were in Nebraska. There was no So this is a poem called Eleanor and Murph's Place. A sudden siren in the dusk beyond the tavern sends the men running. They bang through the screen door, puffing red-faced. Whose is it? West of here, seems like. Marshall's? Doubt it. Too far over. And cards lay face up, face down on the square old table. Foam clings to cold rims of glasses and runs slowly, jaggedly down. The big bladed fan whirs above our heads, and the big posters boom the word, Dance! Chep Festival at Wilbur. And one by one they straggle back with slapping and laughing. Durned old grass fire. Burned down Floyd's outhouse. Too bad he weren't in it. And laughter up and down the bar, the sweet smell of fish frying in the back room kitchen, hats pushed back on the heads as they lined the bar for cold beer with bib overalls and shirts reading Funk's Hybrid and Co-op. And the ancient fire engine pulls around the corner and stops. The room bounces with noise. The four card players at the front table. I'll take two cards. That all? Hand like a foot. And the farmer in bib overalls drinks wine and beer Boilermakers while the ladies from Seward smile and sip sodas. The fresh perch bobs above the heads as the bartender totes the orders from the kitchen, which two boys help cut and ladies from town help fry. Slam the screen door. Who's that come in from the card table? Not from here. Maybe Lincoln. And as astronauts rove the moon, the corners of a far darker world are worn away by fish and beer in Eleanor and Murph's place. Friday night, softball tomorrow at Beaver Crossing. Now, there ought to be a question or a comment or two. That's what I say every day in my class, and of course, there never are any.
When did you start to write poetry? How old were you?
I was late, actually, a late bloomer. I'd probably been fiddling with it, but I had no memory. Grade, because I had fallen madly in love with Laura Lee Appleton, who sat on my left. We, in a classroom with the seventh room, first, second, third, fourth, all the rooms were double in the seventh and eighth grade. Mr. Uffelman, this great 10-foot, 800-pound gorilla who taught, said, read poems today. And when Mr. Uffelman said something, he didn't say, I don't think I will. He did. Or he didn't eat lunch until I'd memorized Luther's Small Catechism cover to cover before I could play kickball. So on my left was Laura Lee Appleton, this little blonde girl with blue eyes, and every time she opened her mouth, little butterflies came out. And on my right was William Craig Miles, who hated poetry and said so. And Mr. Uffelman said, "Read, Jack." And he said, "Open your book and just read." And I looked down, the first line I said, it was Longfellow's Evangeline. And the first line of which is, "This is the forest primeval." And the second line, "I've forgotten something about the home of the murmuring hemlock pines and hemlocks." And I read that line, and I remember stopping and looking out the window, which was covered with wire grating to keep out the kickballs from the other kids who were playing. And I was thinking, this is the forest primeval, thinking, what the heck is that? And I was imagining, what's a forest primeval? I was from the farm in Southern Illinois, I think I'm a forest primeval. And I suddenly realized the room was silent. And I turned around, Mr. Uffelman had walked down and planted his size 12 wingtips right in front of me. He says, "Are you ready to go on?" And he turned around and walked back, and all the kids were looking at me. So I started reading some more. I looked over at Laura Lee, and she just gave me this big smile, because she knew I liked poetry. I looked over at William Craig Miles, and he was going, like that. So naturally, I punched William Craig Miles, and we rolled around, and the next thing I knew, Mr. Uffelman was grabbing us both up and throwing us in the cloakroom, where everybody kept cloaks, of course. Nobody had cloaks, but it was called the cloakroom. And there we were banished for half a day, and Laura Lee, under pretense of sharpening her pencil, which was located in the cloakroom, would come through and say, "Oh, Jack." And William would say, "Oh." And then I would punch William, and then we would get sentences to write, and that's the way it went. I forgot why I told you this story. What was my point? Where was I going?
I don't know, that was a great story.
When you started to
I knew there was a reason for this small digression. I wrote this four-line poem for Laura Lee, and she was very impressed. And it went like this, if I can remember it. "When on the bough of the gnarled oak the November snow doth lie, I will have lived, I will have loved, and in this hour I die." And she said, "Oh, Jack," and William said, "Oh." So for 2 years we did that loving and punching. And so when I went to high school, it was a complete waste for me, because I'd gone to 3 years of parochial school, 6th, 7th, 8th grade. All the rest of my education has been public school. But those 3 years had such an impression that when I went to high school, it was in the 50s when we sort of let kids study what they wanted. If they don't want to study, let them do other things. I did other things. I read one book in 4 years and promptly graduated with a 1.5 GPA, which is a D+. And so I had a lot of trouble finding a school that wanted to take me out of college. So I went underground as far as an intellect and didn't write anything. Wasn't writing anything. Didn't know I could write anything. All memories of Southern Illinois hadn't surfaced yet. And when I finally decided that went to a junior college, and after 5 years there, the dean sidled up to me one day, put his arm around and said, "Jack, you've been with us 5 years now." He said, "You must enjoy it." Well, what I was doing was taking the classes. When I got bored, I'd walk out. So I'd get an F on my transcript because I wouldn't go to the registrar and withdraw. I didn't know what that was. So I'd just go in and out. I'd go in musicals. I was singing and dancing. And he said, "You know, most of our students find that a 2-year college, that 2 years is generally about right. Why don't you move on?" So by that time, my grade point average was probably up to a C-. And to make a long story short, it went eventually to graduate school and all that, so I got that turned around. But then I was teaching at Lutheran High Los Angeles, and when I really started, or teaching elementary school for 4 or 5 years, and I started to write a little bit, because I was teaching reading, and I loved reading, and I was making up stories for the kids. And I was teaching 5th grade once in Culver City, and I was making up stories, and having the kids read Shakespeare, or act out Shakespeare, or read Wordsworth, or Keats, great romantic poets. And I remember once a master teacher supposedly came in, and after class said, "You shouldn't read Robert Frost and Emily Dickinson and Keats to your kids. They don't understand it." I knew he was wrong, and I kept on doing that. So it wasn't until I was actually really teaching high school that I started writing in earnest. And I was taking my kids to a library one day, and I was bored watching my students be bored in the library, so I picked up a book at random, and it was a book of poems by Mark Van Doren, an American poet. And I opened it up at random, and there was a poem called Of Time and Water. about a beaver diving down in the cold, icy stream and coming up in his den. Didn't amount to, it wasn't a significant thing, but it was a beautiful poem. So I just reached over and grabbed one of those little pieces of paper they used to have on the card catalogs. You write down the numbers, which they still have here. And I looked on the back of the book and I saw his name and address, Cornwall Hollow, Connecticut. Beautiful sounding place. So I said, "Dear Mr. Van Doren, just read your poem about the beaver. Liked it a lot. Thanks, Jack." And put it in the mail. Being an impulsive Irishman. Well, 2 weeks later, I got this little note back from Mark Van Doren. It says, "Dear Mr. Ledbetter, glad you liked the poem. It's not about much, just time and water. Do you write?" Little bulb went on. I wrote back and said, "Yes, I do, and here are 10 poems." I wrote 8 of them that night, I think so. He wrote back a week later and said, "I have marked the next, the ones I like." And I think there were 2 he liked. That started what turned out to be a 12-year correspondence with him. And those letters are now in a rare book room at Columbia University of New York, along with Frost and Dickens, or E.A. Robinson, and T.S. Eliot, and things like that, people like that. So anyway, that led to, that sort of turned me on academically, intellectually, and creatively, that one person taking an interest. And then eventually I met him a couple of times and did research on his farm in Connecticut, and published a book of a critical book on Mark Van Doren, which came out this last December. So I was a late bloomer. I had high school kids writing much younger than I was, so it took me a while. And I wrote a lot of stuff until my early years in Illinois, and then going back to Nebraska, living in a small town in Nebraska, unlocked those memories and brought them back. And once they came back, then the floodgates opened, and I've just been writing ever since. So it took a while. That was a long-winded answer to a fairly simple question. I could have said last year. Anything else?
Some favorite images? I mean, do you find yourself going back to certain images or metaphors for life or what? I mean, do you have some favorites? I know some poets that reuse metaphors.
Yep. And, yes. I do, and I worried about it for a long time. If I read enough poems tonight, which I'm not going to do, because as Mark Twain said, it's a bad death to be talked to death, so it's a bad way to go. He also said, if a man wants to carry a tomcat home by the tail, I say let him. He'll learn all there is to know about carrying tomcats that way. I don't know what that has to do with this, but I just thought of it. A lot of my poems have recurring images, like dotted Swiss curtains, which I can remember as a kid on the farm. They were some heavy kind of curtains with heavy, thick little dots in them or something. And shadow, somebody half in shadow, or his breath, the puffs of cloud in the dark, the horses coming up from the fields, their backs steaming like jewels in the dark. I've used those over and over. And then after a while, I realized I was writing the same poem all the time for the last 30 years. It's the same story, only different, hopefully different. Differently. And then I worried about that until I started reading and then teaching courses in William Faulkner. And Faulkner does it all the time. Mm. And so I thought, well, Faulkner could do it. So then I stopped worrying. And so those images, yes, do recur over and over. And now there are so many of them that I have to watch myself now that I don't cannibalize a poem. I could easily have 50 poems with the same images, which would get a little tedious. So I try to watch that now. Let me read a couple of religious poems, since that's what the kiosk promised up there. This is a collection called Gethsemane Poems, and these poems were sort of came about as a result of my going to the Abbey of Gethsemane in Kentucky, where Thomas Merton lived as monk. And if I could be here next week, which we are not going to be, I was going to do sessions on Thomas Merton, because now I teach courses in Thomas Merton at CLU, and he's become a very important in my life, because I had the rare good fortune years ago to read his autobiography, The Seven Story Mountain, which it turned out to be the most influential book I ever read, ever, and it led to all kinds of things which is not particularly important right now, I guess. But if you haven't read Seven Story Mountain, I urge you to do it.
Do we have it here?
Well, I hope so. You know, I think it is. There's the Thomas Merton Reader is in the bookstore. I ordered it for my classes, which I will not teach. Huh. And part of his autobiography is in that, along with some religious essays and some of his poems. His poems are brilliant. Thomas Merton, so I'll do this really just briefly, tell you know about him? I'll make this fast. Thomas Merton was born in France, near Spain. His father was a New Zealander and his mother was from America, and they were painters, and they were over there painting, so he was born. Had a brother 2 years younger. His mother died when he was about 7. His father died when he was about 14. So by the time he was 15, he was an orphan in Europe. So he was taken in by various people, went to some boarding schools. As he grew a little older, he went to Oakham Prep School in England, and a doctor in London became his guardian and funneled money from his maternal grandparents back in Long Island, so it kind of kept him afloat. And Merton was a very brilliant young man. When he was 16 or 17, he was writing essays for newspapers on Gandhi. But not many 16-year-olds were writing essays on Gandhi. But at the same time, he was drinking too much, smoking, running around with girls, getting gated, dormed, or confined to his room. He would tie sheets to the bed and get out of the window. So he's sort of playing soccer. He was a live wire, got into a lot of trouble, but very bright. And then he finally got to Cambridge, and you don't get to Cambridge unless you're very bright, and got drunk and fell in the River Cam, which is okay because it's not any deeper than this anyway, most parts. And so finally, he had some other very serious problems, and they kicked him out. And his guardian, the doctor in London, said, "That's it, I'm not going to pay any more of these bills. I'm out of here. Go back to America." So they put him on a ship, sent him back to his maternal grandparents in Long Island. And he thought, now he's 21 years old. And he said, "I've got to turn my life around somehow." So he took the train from Long Island to Columbia, downtown New York, and enrolled in what he thought was a history class, or econ. And he walked in there, and his room was full of people, and up in the front was this white-haired, very serious-looking scholar talking about Shakespeare. And he said, "I'm in the wrong class." But he didn't want to disturb people by walking out, so he sat there. And after the hour, he realized he was never going to leave. He was hooked on Shakespeare, and the man's name, the teacher, was Mark Bandura, who later became my mentor and my friend. So to make this shorter, Thomas Merton, who had lived this very raucous life, continued to live a raucous life, liked beer, smoked too much, ran around, liked hot jazz in New York City. But as he went through his classes, he started reading more books on theology. He'd read a lot of, somebody gave him a couple of Catholic books. And he was on the train back to Long Island, and he was looking through this book, and on the inside cover had the imprimatur, which means this book has been okayed by the Catholic censors. It has no false doctrine. That scared him to death. He says, "Who's the Catholic Church to tell me what I can read?" So he opened the window of the train, and he started to throw this book out. But he said, "Well, I just paid $22 for that book." He brought it back and said, "I guess I'll read it anyway." He started reading that, and he read more and more. And one day he was sitting in his room around the corner from Columbia and reading the letters of Gerard Manley Hopkins, who was a Jesuit priest and an excellent poet. And Gerard Manley Hopkins had converted to Catholicism in the 19th century from Oxford and was received into the church by John Henry Newman, who became a cardinal. And now Merton was reading Hopkins, and Merton stood up and said, "I'm going to be a Catholic." And he ran down to Corpus Christi Church around the corner, told the father he wanted to be a Catholic. 2 weeks later, he was baptized. He says, "I want to be a monk." And all his friends kept saying, "Excuse me, are you the Tom Merton we just got drunk with last night? You'll be a monk?" "Right." "I don't think so." So he continued to carouse around and have a good time, but meanwhile he'd go home at night and study. He had the breviary, and he did got up and prayed the hours at 3 in the morning. He was doing all this, nobody knew. Got his master's from Columbia, taught school at a couple of years in St. Bonaventure's in upstate New York. It was a Catholic school. And one day he said, "I want to be a monk. I want to be a priest." And one of the fathers took him seriously, said, "Why don't you become a Franciscan?" He said, "I'll do it." So he wrote the Franciscans in New York City and said, "I want to be a Franciscan priest, or in your order." So they sent him a big form to fill out, tell me your life history, and come in and have an interview, which he did. And this is where you unburden yourself. "My son, tell us everything you've ever done, get it off your chest, and we'll see you." So Merton took them at his word and told them everything. Everything. And the poor priest who was listening just broke out in a sweat. I said, oh, you did that? You did several times you did that? Oh, I don't want to hear this. You tell me some more. 3 hours later, Merton went out, felt relieved, walked on air because he had unburdened, got all of his past things out of the way. Week later, he got a letter back, I don't think you're for us. And they wouldn't have him. So he was crushed. He said, I thought I was supposed to be forgiven, but I don't think so. So another father up there said, why don't you go down for a retreat at an abbey down in Kentucky, south of Louisville, called Abbey of Gethsemane. Just go down there during Lent, see what you think. So he got on the train, went down there. He got up at 2:30 in the morning, prayed with the monks, worked in the fields, said his prayers, studied. At the end of that week, he went back up to New York and wrote a letter back, said, I'd like to come back for good. Can I come? And they wrote back, said, come. No questions asked. So he quit St. Bonnie's, Bonaventure's, and went down to Abbey, walked in, stayed there 27 years. Became the most famous monk of the 20th century. And his books are books that you should know. A Sign of Jonas, Conjectures of Guilty Bystander. He wrote about 50 or 60 books. This is a man who got up at 2:30 in the morning, prayed all day, worked in the fields, went to bed at 8 at night when it was still light at 10 o'clock, and still had time to write 50 books. Drove the abbot crazy. Anyway, it's a long-winded thing about who Thomas Merton was. But that's where these poems came from. Because when I got interested in Merton, I went down there. Dolores and I have been there once. And I spent a week's retreat there. I skipped graduation at CLU to go down and be with the monks. And when I came back from there, got on the bus, went back up to my hometown in Greenville, Illinois, walked into the kitchen of the farmhouse, my Auntie M says, you've been down there monking around with them monks, haven't you, Jack? And I wouldn't have put it that way, but I said, well, I've been down with the monks. She said, what did they teach you? She's a hard-shelled Baptist. I said, well, it's kind of hard to say. She said, well, don't trust me. And that was that. But I never got over that experience either. So let me, you might as well close this out with a poem or two from, my aunt still doesn't trust him, but I do. She finally did ask me, she says, what good are they? They don't just stay there in their monastery, like nuns in a convent. What good are they? So I didn't want to get in an argument with my aunt, because she was formidable, besides which she was making apple cobbler, and I knew I wouldn't get any if I got testy, so I didn't want to get her riled. So I said, well, do you believe in prayer? She said, I'm a Baptist in a hardship. Are you asking me if I believe in prayer? Of course I believe in prayer. I said, well, there's 174 men down there praying for you, and they don't even know you. I got my apple cobbler. Okay, I'll close with one with a poem here, unless you have some more questions. Anything? Say anything? Comments? It's called This Winter Church. Beneath the silence of our winter robes beat hearts of summer's Christ, as we touch the holy water sending ripples across the face of God, and feel the spirit moving among shadows of the starlings that swoop and dive beyond the frozen windows to gather on the thrumming wires sending up our silent songs. Before we weave our scarlet thread of song among the iron bells, and this winter church becomes our Ave Maria and our birth breath, as we sink beneath the mystery of bread and wine, where Christ walks on the sea of our Eucharist.